Hello, my name's Roger Watson, and I'm the Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Advanced Nursing, and welcome to the JAN podcast. These occasional podcasts will be a miscellany of my reflections on working as an Editor-in-Chief, some hot topics in academic publishing, and occasional contributions from guest editors. This is the JAN podcast of 20th of September 2015.
So you need to take other pictures.
We'll all be on Facebook tomorrow.
Very warmly welcome to this lecture by Professor Roger Watson. And the lecture is about scientific writing, waking up the reader's attention. And I am very pleased to introduce Professor Roger Watson. He is from the University of Hull, and he is an internationally known expert in nursing science. And he has involved in extensive international studies. And as an editor-in-chief in the leading journal of the nursing science, Journal of Advanced Nursing, he is in central place regarding questions and challenges in scientific writing. And today, we all have excellent opportunity to share our comments and questions, opinions about scientific writing and its challenges after his lecture. And I am Anna-Maja Pietilä, and I'm as chair of day, and Professor Roger Watson, you are very warmly welcome to our university and to our department. Please, floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Right, where are you going to sit? Yes, thank you very much indeed. Right, I wasn't expecting quite so many people, so it's very nice to see you all. I think we must be just at the limits of health and safety. If there's a fire, you'll have to jump out the windows. And it's very nice. It's going to get very hot in here, I can predict. And I might have to take my tie off later. I'm really pleased to be here. It's my opportunity to be here to speak to you. I've been to Finland many times, but never to Kuopio, so this is really nice to be here. It would be nicer if the sun was shining, but it's very nice. Now, I always have a preamble like this because I want to make sure that you can understand what I'm saying. Is that okay? Yeah, good. I mean, I know that your English is very good everywhere in this part of the world, but I'm not English, I'm Scottish. I have a slightly different accent from some people, and some of the words I say might sound different. For instance, when I say nursing, people say, what? Nursing. So we pronounce the R's a little bit like German people do. So some words you might think, well, what's it, I'm sure you'll get there eventually. I've been asked to talk, well, I was given a 90-minute slot. I hope I won't talk for 90 minutes. I hope that you will talk for some of it and ask me some questions. But maybe with the number of people here, we should maybe not have questions while I'm talking. I'm usually quite willing to do that, but there's just too many people. But I'll talk for an hour or so, and then we can have some questions after that. Okay. And tomorrow I'm meeting the doctoral students on a less formal basis, so you can be thinking of things you might want to ask me tomorrow. If you don't have questions, I just talk, so make sure you've got questions. That's what my wife always says. If nobody asks a question, you just carry on talking. You know, so there you go. Good. So we're here to talk about waking up the reader's attention. That's what I was asked to do. My first job, I hope, is to wake up your attention and hold it, because I think people will start to nod off in this very warm room after a while. And just thanks for the introduction. That's very, very, very good, very accurate. By the way, I will give these slides to Mari, and she can give them to you. Okay. You're welcome to take photographs of me, but the slides are available for you. I meant to send them before. I'm sorry, I just forgot. Okay, but I'm the editor of the Journal of Advanced Nursing, which is a traditional. We still produce a hard copy for publicity purposes, but it's a traditional volumized journal. We publish a certain number of papers every year. We publish some of them open access. Everything's available online, but it's not an open access journal. It's considered to be traditional. I also edit Nursing Open, which is an open access, online only journal. No hard copy produced at any stage. So you might want to ask about that as well. There are two kind of opposite ends of the spectrum. JAN is not the biggest journal in the field. It's the second biggest in the field. The biggest is the one I used to edit, the Journal of Clinical Nursing. We're not the top of the impact factor stakes, although we're in the top 10 again, but we are the highest cited by a long way. So the number of citations in total for our journal outstrip nearly all the other ones by several hundred, several thousand, I think, in some cases. And JCN is next. Nursing Open, on the other hand, is brand new. It's only been going for a couple of years. We've only published a couple of issues. So I'm working at both ends of the spectrum with a very successful, well-established journal. Next year it will be 40 years old. It'll be almost as old as me. And Nursing Open, which is just a baby by comparison. So you might want to ask me about those two models later on. Believe me, that's the model for the future. This is a dinosaur, okay? This is like a brontosaurus, I think, that's going to die if it doesn't adapt and change. We are adapting and changing, but that's the model there. Right, so good. So I'll crack along. That's how most of us. That's supposed to be funny, by the way. Okay, I know senses of humour don't always transfer too well between countries, but I think everybody can get the idea. That's you, me. I'm a writer and publisher as well. I try to get things into writing. I get things rejected. Okay, I know what rejection is like, just as much as you do. None of us can be guaranteed to get to the end. And what we feel about the editorial process is there are people like me along the way. That's me. That's my managing editor, first of all. That's me. Waiting just, you know, to whack us down as soon as we put a paper in. Very unfair, isn't it? Why don't they just publish everything you send in? You know? And then you've got editors, and then, you know, ultimately death's head, you know, to take the legs from you. But if you can negotiate this, then you'll get your paper accepted. Now, I can't give you a guaranteed way to get your paper accepted. That's just impossible. But I can give you a guaranteed set of rules for not getting your paper published, okay? So everything I say are not guaranteed mechanisms, but if you don't do them, you definitely won't get through. So what I was asked to do was to talk about grabbing the reader's attention. And I'm sure most of you are thinking, the reader, well, that's going to be the ultimate recipient of the paper, somebody in a library, your mum, your dad, your colleagues or whatever, but no, I'm going to take a different approach to that, to try and get in one or two of the things that I think are essential about the writing for publication process. So first of all, you need to understand what the competition is. You're up against a lot of papers being submitted. For example, in my own journal, I hope you can see this at the back, I'll read it out in case not. In my own journal, last year, in total, we had 1,110 submissions. That was a low year. We've had as many as 1,400 papers in, so we get lots of papers. We had papers from 55 different countries, so you're competing against a lot of people, and you're competing against a lot of different countries. The top country last year was the USA, then the UK, Australia, you know, you can see that the English-speaking countries, native English-speaking countries, are at the top. That's just the way it is. We're not an English journal. We're English-speaking. We're not even UK. We're international. But it's just the way it goes. These countries have been at it a bit longer. However, you can see that there are certain countries. There might be people here from these parts of the world. China, Taiwan are creeping up in terms of the number of papers that are being submitted and being published. And if you included China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, which is down in that brick there somewhere, that would be the biggest single set of submissions to the paper, Greater China, as I call it. I know for Taiwanese people, if there's any present, that's very politically incorrect, but for those collections of Chinese countries, that's the biggest single group of countries coming in. So your competition's coming from the Far East and Southeast Asia. Now, every time I'm in Finland, I'm surprised nobody's put their hand up yet and asked me. People say, "But what about Finland?" Okay, so Finland is 16th in this list here, so it's just down about there somewhere, with 18 manuscripts. So you're pretty good, and that's a lot better than you were maybe 4 or 5 years ago. You're creeping up. I think Netherlands and Sweden are probably just still above you. I didn't give the whole list, but I can get it out if people, you know, later if people want to have a look at it. Okay, the other thing you've got to appreciate, don't look at all the figures here. The figure that's important here is that in 2014, I'm using the latest set of figures, the total percentage of acceptance to the journal was 19.5%, okay? So we publish just under a fifth of the papers that we get in. And that percentage is just going to go down, because every year, despite the fact we've had a drop, every year the trend is that more and more papers are coming in. And because of the model that we publish, 300 papers roughly a year, we have a limit to the number of papers we can publish. So I don't want to depress you or make you suicidal, jump out the window and think, well, there's no chance of getting published. What you've got to think about is, how do I get into that 20%? You know, it is possible to get published. Even I sometimes get published in my own journal. I also get rejected by my own journal, okay? So I'm in exactly the same boat as you are. So don't think that I'm speaking from any position of... speaking from a position of experience, much of it rough. I've lived a lot longer than most of you, but I'm not talking from any level of superiority in terms of getting published. I've just been at it a lot longer. So we pay attention to these figures so that you can know about them and think about them, keep it in the back of your mind. You will not get published if you just send papers in without thinking about it, without really paying attention to what we want. You will not get published, that's for sure. Hi.
Yes. I was wondering about the figure for immediate rejection.
For immediate rejection. Oh, okay, right, okay. Well, okay, I'm glad. You came in late. I'm quite happy to have the question, because I'm going to come to this in a minute. Okay, about immediate rejection. We'll not have time for questions while I talk, but I'll leave some time at the end, okay? I like to be informal, but there's too many people for it. But since you've asked, okay, and since you've sat yourself on the floor in front of me, which is very, very, very comfortable, I'll answer your question. Immediate reject. I haven't got a clear path to run from the room. This is my job, immediate rejection, okay? Every paper that comes to the journal, the first person to see the paper is me. There's an inbox on the online system, and only I have access to that. Well, my managers and my assistant have, but nobody else, none of the other editors have. And I can make an immediate decision as to whether I want to reject the paper or not. And I'll come back to why I might want to do that in a minute. Right, so I think what you've got to think about is waking up the reader's attention, and this is really the sort of addressing the argument that I was asked to argue about, or the point I was trying to ask to address. Who are your readers? Okay, well, I'm not going to ask you the question because we haven't got time to take questions, but your readers are me, okay? That's who you've got to think about. Your reader is, first of all, the editor-in-chief of my journal, or any journal. It's the first person who sees the paper. That's the person you've got to waken up and grab their attention. If you don't do that, you're finished. There's no point in thinking about your mum, your dad, your sister, your brother, your colleagues, or your employers or anybody. They will never see the paper coming out if you don't grab that person's attention. So everything I'm going to say from now on is about grabbing these people's attention. then the editors, or in some cases associate editors. In my journal, I'll show you the process. There's a very distinct process through which the papers go, and at each stage, yes, you can get to the next stage, but at each stage you can also be rejected. Then the reviewers, you need to address what they want, and I'm going to come back right at the end to dealing with reviewers' comments as the last thing I'm going to say in the session. Finally, your audience, okay? Now, you've obviously got to think about your audience, but what you've got to think about is making sure that this man or woman, in the case of the Journal of Advanced Nursing, that's me, then the editors, then reviewers, then your audience. So you've got to make sure that you address what these people want all the way through. So what I want to do is to tell you how to maximise that. No guarantees, okay? I don't know if any of you gamble or go to horse racing. I don't very often, but I do. Twice a year, I go. It's getting worse. It's doubled already. I go in Hong Kong once a year, and I go to Ascot in the UK once a year, both because Cathay Pacific, who are my airline, invite me to go to it, okay? Now, if you go to horse racing, you don't just walk in and take all your money out and just throw it on the first horse you see, unless you're stupid. You look at the odds and you say, right, that's got short odds, that's probably the favourite. I'm not likely to win too much, but I'll try that one. You don't just throw your money away. You make a decision. You try and maximise the chances. So what I want to do is help you to maximise those chances. Now, you won't see this, and I'm not expecting, don't draw it or write it down or photograph it or anything, I'll send it to you. It's just a sort of, to show you there is a very distinct process through which a paper goes. You might have guessed this or known it already, but it's quite clear that some people don't understand the process when I deal with authors. So I'm not going to go through it in detail, but essentially manuscripts are submitted, and then I can look at them, and I can reject them or send them on. They're seen by an editorial assistant, who will check them for similarity using Authenticate. I will come back to talk about similarity later. So if it's too similar, it can be rejected at that stage. We have some internal rules about the decisions that are made. We do exercise some judgment. If it's then checked by, I'm very lucky, I've got a full-time member of staff working at the journal, and she looks at the paper in great detail. I mean, she actually looks at it for content, for length, for organize, all sorts of things. If she considers that it's not good enough, again, it could be rejected at that point. These people don't need to make any reference to me. Once I put the paper on, I've been grabbed by it, but they've got to make their own decisions. Then it goes through to editors and reviewers. It comes back to the reviewers. Sorry, it comes back from the reviewers to the editors. And, of course, it can be rejected at that stage. But if you're lucky, you might get to revise the paper, and it goes through that process again, essentially. And we try to allow it only to go through that process once more. So we try to give you as much guidance as possible to make sure it does get through the process successfully. So the first part of the process that you've really got to be aware of is, if you don't get rejected, you will get, it's one or the other, really. If you don't get rejected, you'll get asked to do revisions. You'll never be asked, you'll never be accepted straight away. That never happens. If you get asked to do revisions, rejoice, be happy, have a glass of beer or whatever it takes to make you happy, you know, really be pleased and realise that the door, it's like the window, that they're open, it's open for you to get in. But many people don't see it that way. I mean, I have PhD students and colleagues, oh, I've got revisions, so should we try another journal? No, you know, try that journal, they're interested in your paper. They've given you some ideas of what to do, do them, and I guarantee that 90% of the time or more you will be accepted. That's not much of a guarantee, it's only 90%, but, you know, it's you've really got a high chance, you're really in with a high chance of getting accepted. So you've got to get into that mentality of taking that chance and getting the paper through the system. Then it goes through, if it gets accepted, then it goes off to production, and the production process makes it look like a paper, the one that's published, and it's not finished then, you've still got to check the proof, it's your last chance to check it. But that's out of the editorial process altogether. Okay, so just trying to understand what's happening. Those are the different steps in the process. What's happening at each of these steps? Well, the submission process is really in your hands, and this is all part of quality control. What we're wanting is you to submit a paper that looks as good as it possibly can be and conforms to all the sort of things that we want it to conform to. So this is your responsibility, but we have a responsibility too, and we make the guidance available. I'll come back to that in a minute. So we expect various international standards, authorship, ethics and such like to be adhered to here. I think I'm going to come back to ICMJE guidance later, so don't worry about that at the moment. Then the next part of the process that you're aware of, if the paper hasn't been rejected earlier, that is the peer review process. And peer review process can be blind or open, and the peer review process is a process whereby experts, we hope they're experts, are asked to look at your paper. When you get the paper back, you may not think that they're experts, but they're our experts, and you've got to pay attention to what they say. We use a blind system of reviewing at the Journal of Advanced Nursing, and at Nursing Open, but increasingly you'll find journals like BMC, PLOS One, one or two other journals use open systems. Again, we can discuss that at the end. I'm very much in favour of both for different reasons. They have different purposes, but I'm veering towards open review, but we stick to blind review. Then the editor will, you don't hear from the reviewers, and just be aware of this, reviewers don't make decisions, reviewers give us advice. The editor makes the decision, and the editor will feed back to you it looks very negative, the reasons for rejection, but also the reasons for revision. You'll be given these, and you will get feedback at this stage. You don't get feedback at the immediate reject stage. All the feedback you get at that stage is it doesn't fit the journal. You try and get it back to you quickly. I do it within 24 hours, and you get the chance to submit it elsewhere. At this stage, you'll get some proper feedback. Then you'll be asked to revise it. We still minor or major, doesn't really mean much these days. Don't worry about whether this. Don't worry if in the letter it says this paper requires major revisions. Just ignore it. It requires revisions. Okay? Because I've seen minor revisions that are 10 pages long and major revisions that are 1 page long. It's just so we most journals don't use that anymore. We don't, but you'll still see some that do. And what we're trying to do is to help you to improve the quality of the paper. We're not trying to be awkward, okay? We're trying to say, you know, we're saying we're interested in this paper. Here's what to do to get it to a publishable state. And if you don't do that, it will not be published. Simple as that. Then the paper goes to production. You don't need to know much about production, but there are further quality assurance checks at production. And this is the stage often at which we really get it into house style. I mean, I'll have edited it to my style, and you'll often see changes on the way through. Don't change them back to your own style. They're there for a reason. Production, proofreading, sub-editing, all the rest of it gets it up to a really... it shouldn't have anything wrong with it when it comes out of production and back to you, but believe me, they often do, so you've got to check them. And finally, and we may have time to talk about this, I'll talk about it briefly here, once the paper's published, quality assurance, quality issues don't end then, in a sense. There's still post-publication scrutiny. Now, at one time, that was rare. I mean, at one time, occasionally somebody would pick up a paper, make a comment about it, write to you, or write to a journal about it. And whether those comments are negative or positive, you should always be glad to see them. It's a citation for your paper. Always respond to them. Don't run away from them. But these days with Twitter and blogging and Facebook and LinkedIn and all the different social media, there's lots and lots of post-publication scrutiny of papers. People can easily access it online. They can make comments about it. And we try to encourage this because it's very good for the journal. It's very good for the papers. So if you publish a paper in my journal, it will go out on Twitter. It will soon go out on Facebook. Well, because it's on my Facebook, it will soon go out on a journal Facebook soon. It will probably, if it's really good, go out on the blog. It's all opportunities for people to comment and engage with the paper. We try to get our retaliation in first by sending the paper out, pushing it out through social media. Okay, so the peer review process is a kind of cyclical process. You know, these people here, gatekeepers, the editors and the reviewers kind of lie between you and getting the paper published, but eventually the paper should pop out of that process and get published if you've done everything right and it's got into the system at the beginning. So what I want to talk about in terms of grabbing the reader's attention, I've got what I call four rules of writing. I'm not going to talk about them all because there's only two that are really relevant today. And these four rules, just for your interest, I can talk more about them to the doctors, students tomorrow if they want. First one is reading the guidelines. The second is setting realistic targets and counting wards. We won't talk about that today. Seeking criticism, I will talk about. And this is something that's not so much a rule that I can talk about. It's more of a mentality that you have to adopt if you're in the, if you're serious about writing for publication, and I'm guessing because you're here today that you are, treat every rejection as the beginning of the next submission. Okay, if a paper's rejected, it's not a matter of dishonour, suicide, or you know, mental illness, or whatever, or resignation. It's a matter of saying, right, they don't like my paper, they're obviously wrong, you know, so I'm going to send it somewhere else straight away. Okay, you've obviously got to turn it around a little bit and conform to the new guidelines, but always have the mentality and maintain it. You've done the work, the paper will get published somewhere. It just might not get published where you sent it to, first of all. So that's part of being strategic and tactical, but we don't have time to talk about that today. What I want to talk about is reading the guidelines and seeking criticism. And reading the guidelines is really the best way to attract the attention or waken up, as it were, the editor-in-chief. Because the editor-in-chief is specifically looking for a set of things in that paper that will clearly indicate that you have actually read the guidelines. That's the most important thing to me. I'm a very superficial, shallow person, okay? I just want to see that it looks right. So, we try not to make a secret of our guidance, although on the Wiley webpage you think we did, they're buried away down at the bottom left. I think we should be up there in big letters, but they're way down there on the bottom left. But every journal, whether it's mine, Nursing Open, International Journal of Nursing, any journal or whatever your field is, will have a set of guidelines. You have to read them, they're there for a reason. Don't just think that they're there for other people, they're there for you. And you know, the first thing I do when I think of a journal I'm going to go to is I go to the guidance. If there's a summarised form of it, I'll print it out. Don't print ours out, there's nearly 10 pages of it, but say the guidance is copious. There's 10 pages of single space, size 11 Arial font if you print ours out in a Word document, and that doesn't include all the hypertext and links to all the other guidance. It's copious. But our guidance is very specific to every single type of paper. So if you're putting a clinical trial in, or a systematic review, or a qualitative paper, we have different sets of guidance for each type of paper. So you need to follow those. So again, the guidance can seem like a bit of an obstacle to get over, but it's there to help you. It more or less tells you how to write the paper. So we're looking, or I'm looking at the beginning, quite simply, has this person followed the most superficial part of the guidelines that I can see? Is the abstract in the right format? Is the headline, are the headings and subheadings in the right order? You know, is it spaced? Does it look right? Very superficial. But if you haven't done that, I know you haven't read the guidance. So I'm not interested. We haven't got time. I hope it doesn't sound arrogant. I don't really care if it does or not. That's the way it goes. I'm sorry, we don't have time to deal with papers where people haven't followed the guidance. You may have rediscovered the double helical structure of DNA or split the atom or whatever. Doesn't matter. If it's not written properly or following the guidance, we'll never know. Nobody will ever know, you know. So you will get you'll get poor science that's better presented, published more easily than really excellent science that isn't presented properly, that's for sure. Remember that. And that's any editor will tell you that. Hopefully you'll get it published somewhere else, but you just won't get it published in a top quality journal. So the things you need to look for in the guidelines, these are the things that we're looking for right at the beginning of the process. Length of the paper. Okay, we specify a length and we mean it. We very rarely go beyond it. We specify 5,000 words, and we specify them from the beginning of the introduction to the end of the discussion. We don't include the abstracts, we don't include the references, we don't include the tables. That's all specified in the journal. I answer an email at least once a week from people asking me, does your word length include that, you know, that's in the guidance? Okay, I do answer those politely, but you know what I mean? It's there for you to read, and we rarely go over that. So if you submit a manuscript that's, you know, 8,500 words long, I mean, the record is something like 20,000, I think, is one that I got in. We won't even discuss it with you or ask you to cut it down. It will be rejected, okay? It's, you know, okay, you can cut it down and resubmit it as a completely fresh submission. We'll never know. There's nothing to stop you doing that. We probably won't even tell you why. You should be able to, we just reject it. We just haven't got time to deal with it, okay? Now, some journals which have fewer manuscripts coming in will have time to deal with these things, but what we just don't. We still like the paper to be laid out properly. I was so pleased to see in a journal which I'm submitting to at the moment, the Scandinavian Journal of Occupational Therapy. I work outside nursing quite a bit, and I was so glad to see that it asked for double spacing with wide margins in the electronic format. That's exactly what you should do. Don't cram it into single space and try and save paper, because we're not going to print it anyway, you know. Don't have little font like that that we can't see. You know, it's your job to make it big, wide, you know, plenty of space for comments and reading. You know, make it really, as a colleague of mine always says, make it look like a scientific paper, make it look easy to read. So get the layout right, we specify that too. Very important to get the organisation of the paper right, by which I mean headings, subheadings, and the order of those, and I will come back to those. And again, it's a totally easy shot for me to look at the paper and to see if it's in the right order or not. If it's not in the right order, again, I'm labouring the point, you haven't followed the guidelines. Referencing system, okay, we're not going to worry if you don't get every full stop, comma, and bracket. Absolutely correct, because let you into secret, we've got systems that can correct those automatically. They can pick up references and they're done very quickly by macros. However, if you use the Vancouver system, in my journal, which uses the Harvard system, then, you know, that's the quickest way to get rejected, because I know absolutely not that you just haven't read the guidance, you've never read the journal, okay? So please make sure you get the right referencing system. Now, I think you'll agree that this is all very superficial stuff, but it's dead easy to get right, okay? You know, this is the stuff that I want to see, because I don't want to insult my editors or my reviewers by having to wade through papers that are difficult to read, badly spaced, badly organised. That's all I'm interested in. I'm not an expert in what you're going to submit or you're going to submit. I can't possibly be, you know. There is more to it than this, but this is the headlines. So the organisation, get the right material in the right place. Now this is moving on to the editors and the reviewers and your readers as well. So there's a bit of overlap between this, but this is what people want to see. They want to see the right material in the right place. Scientific publishing is at one level quite boring. It's quite staid. It's quite, how can I put it? It's very boxed in by rules and regulations. But they're there to make information easy to present and easy to find. Certainly the PhD students amongst you, you'll all be reviewing lots of papers. I hope you are for your PhD. But I mean, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but you know, do you read every part of every paper that you download? I can answer the question for you now. I don't know where you are. No, you don't, because I don't. You know, I download papers in my field of methodology on item response theory to see how did they do the item response theory. I don't care whether it's in occupational therapy, sexual health, psychology or sports science. I want to see how they did the method. It may happen to be in dementia and feeding and activities of daily living, which I'm interested in, I might read. So I know where to look. I look in the methods. You know, it's easy. That's what it's about. It's about presenting stuff that's easy to find. And different reviewers will look at different things and they want to find it there. They don't want to find a bit of methods in the introduction and a bit of discussion in the results. You know, we want things to be discreetly boxed in within the paper. So get the right material in the right place. What's the, you know, make it clear what the issue is that you're writing about. You wouldn't believe the number of reviews that I get back, where I thought the paper looked okay, but the reviewer says, I actually don't know what this person is trying to investigate. They haven't made it clear. Now that's easy by having a good research question, but make it clear. Make it clear at the beginning. Make it clear in the title. Make it clear in the abstract. Make it clear in the introduction. Make it clear at the end of the background. Make it clear in the methods. Make it clear in the discussion. You know, tell them what you're going to do. Tell them again and remind them at the end. In slightly different words, but make it clear what it is that you've done. And what is the gap in knowledge that needs to be filled? Why are you doing this? You know, you're not doing it just for fun or for your PhD. You may be. But you've got to convince the reader that there's a gap that you're trying to fill. There's something that we don't know that you're trying to find out about. Again, that's often not clear. What exactly have you found? Again, this should all be in the abstract, to be honest. What have you found? And why does it matter? Does it matter? Which in clinical fields is easy to get across, because it matters, because it will have some sort of impact on patient care or on management or education or something like that. Oops. Okay, so organising the paper is all about getting that sort of material into the right places. I'm not going to go through in detail where everything goes, but if you look at the guidance of the paper, it makes it clear what each section of the paper should have. Or look at published papers, they've gone through the process. But, you know, think where these things should go. But my kind of hint is to try and get as much of this into each section as possible. You know, keep making sure that you, without exaggerating, but don't underplay what you've done. Make it clear at each stage. So a published paper should be like a painting. You know, you should start with the background to the painting. You know, if you're a watercolorist like my father was, you always did the sky and let it wash down before he did the foreground and focused in on the details at the front. Not a very good analogy for a painting, but you know what I mean. Try and set a broad picture at the front and then focus down on the details. So that gives the paper a kind of order, and that orders the different contents, the different aspects that I spoke about there. So the order of contents. Like an abstract discussion, you know, those are the usual things. I'm going to send these PowerPoints out as well, so you're welcome to take photographs, but you'll get the PowerPoints after if you want. Take photographs of me. So these are all important parts of the paper, okay? And I'm going to talk about some of them, but not all of them. And of course, the most important parts for me are these two, the title and the abstract. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that in the other parts. Okay, so what you're trying to do with the headings and subheadings is to direct the person through the paper from beginning to end, but also if they need to go back to check, if you're reading the results and you think, how did they do that? Well, you know where to find it. It's in the methods section. It's not in the discussion. It's not in the introduction. You know exactly where it is. So you're signposting things throughout the paper. So titles are very, very important. They should be as short as possible. There's been a habit in nursing, there's been a habit certainly in qualitative research, there are very, very long titles. And my colleague Mark Hayter, who's also an editor on the journal and a frequent visitor to Finland as well, has some really good examples of long titles. I haven't got them here today, but he's got some really good ones. One of them is his own, which he did when he was much younger and much more. Now, you know, we all make mistakes, you know. But you know, more than a couple of lines in a title, and you know, we're beginning to fall asleep. So try and make them as short as possible, and clearly related to the topic of the paper. If the paper's about, you know, the cognitive behavioural therapy in post-myocardial infarction patients, that's the title of your paper with a couple of words at either end. It doesn't need to be anything obscure, you know. Don't try to be poetic or too clever or literary or anything like that. It doesn't really help. You've got to be really good to work in clever titles. And I'm not very good at it. But I don't know how many... You're all too young to remember a band called Led Zeppelin. Yeah. You remember Led Zeppelin? Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Some people do. You maybe heard of it. Your dad told you about it. Okay. Well, they have a paper called... they do have a paper. I've got a paper which is entitled Stairway to Heaven. It's about spirituality. Item response theory of spirituality. Stairway to Heaven is one of the top songs. You know. Anyway, so we thought that was quite clever. It obviously didn't make such an impression here. Okay, try to get the vital information in at the beginning of the paper. If the paper is a randomised controlled trial, that's really important. So a randomised controlled trial of... If it's a systematic review of, okay? I know there's been a habit over the years of blah-de-blah-de-blah-de-blah, colon, a randomised controlled trial, or, you know, we'll go through that again, blah-blah-blah, colon, a randomised controlled trial. What we like now is to have it clearly stated, a randomised controlled trial. Now, some journals will may say otherwise, but for my journal, that's what we like. And there's some evidence, not very strong, but some evidence that helps them to be found online. That makes them more Googleable, basically. Okay, everybody uses Google. Okay, so that makes them more easy to find. And you want your paper to be found. You want your paper to be read. You want your paper to be cited. We want it to be found, read, and cited too. Now, that's one. I've given you the examples. Now, the introduction, we actually ask for an introductory section separate from the background. So I would say you've maybe got 1,000 words or so to play with at the beginning of a paper. Some journals ask you to do an introduction or a background. I think they're different. Either way, for example, if a journal says you must have a background section, the first part of that background should be as wide as possible, should be an introduction, okay? I'm not just playing with words there. I think it should be as wide as possible, and you should place the study in the policy, practice, research, education, whatever context you're coming from, so that people immediately know which arena they're in. But don't spend too long about this, you know, but just get across, you know, where this paper's coming from. You don't need to have any references here either. Maybe a key reference to a government document or a key paper in the area, but don't bore your readers with lots and lots of references at this point. Just make a nice statement in the beginning, maybe a few hundred words about, you know, where the paper's coming, why it needs to be done. Then again, in the background, you go into that in more detail, and there you can look at literature. Okay, so you can separate these two things out. So what I'm saying is that anybody reading the introduction, that bit, you know, I don't know, that long at the top of the paper, okay, it shouldn't go over a page, basically, you know, just a mechanical thing. Reading that much of your paper should have a very clear idea of what it's about while you're doing it, okay? That's what I'm trying to get across, grabbing the reader's attention. Don't bury it away. Don't say, well, I'm going to make people really work to find out what this paper's about. Tell them, okay? It's your job to make them interested. Don't make them. They don't need to get a head torch and a pickaxe out to find what's there. It does happen. So you should contain a problem statement in the introduction. It should, nursing education in the UK is under threat because of a. Politicians thinking that it shouldn't be in universities, for example. You know, that's a problem statement. How are we dealing? This paper addresses this using evidence from outcomes of graduates versus non-graduate nurses, something like that. You know, get people interested. Oh, that's interesting. That is a problem. Let's see what they've done. So, what's the problem? What is it? Why is the problem worth studying? Well, the problem is worth studying. It's the nursing education one because. The threat is that nursing education in the UK might be taken out of universities or it won't get funding or whatever. Why are you studying the problem? You're studying it because you want to do something about it. It's important in your country or your region, or it's important for the world. And why would anyone be interested? Well, you can think about these things for everything that you're writing. You know, think again. Really, why would anybody be interested? They'd be interested because of those things there. Try and keep these things foremost in your mind. Sorry. Okay. So then the background is essentially a literature review, and this is where you don't go to town. Trying to use English idioms. You don't go into detail in the first section about this, but here you really want to explain, you know, what it is you're addressing in terms of gaps in the literature. So what's already known, what gaps will it fill, and what questions will be addressed by the paper. By questions, I mean research questions. You should always try to encapsulate what it is you're doing in a research question if possible. And my view is, and it's very common, is that the research question should come at the end of this background section, and it should lead on to the methods section. Some journals say it should be in the methods section, but if they don't say that, have it at the end of the background, because everything you're writing about there should lead up to it. So again, addressing the theme that I've been asked to talk about, grabbing the reader's attention, you know, when they get to the end of that section of literature, which may not have really excited them too much, you know, it's the academic process, but they'll get to them, right, that's what they're doing, that's the research question. You know, you've woken them up again, you've grabbed their attention. They want to know what you're doing and how you're going to do it. Should end with the research question. In quantitative research, you can also end with the hypothesis if you want. If there's an overall hypothesis especially, but it might be more common to break these down in the results in the methods section because you'll be addressing them with different methods. But that's up to you. I'm not making a hard and fast rule here. In terms of style of writing, I think it's quite a good idea to... I'm looking at my watch to check my time there. I'm wondering what I'm looking at now. In terms of grabbing readers' attention, this is just something that is not on the slide, but... While you're writing and jumping from one section to another, it's a really good idea to use joining phrases like you know in the next section I will do this and whatever. You know, don't overuse it, but do try and guide them in so they know that they're making a transition. You know, so you know this. You know, having dealt with the background literature, the next section will deal with you know the you know the, you know what what research has been used to address the problem, you know, leading up to how you're going to do it, you know. And another thing to do at the end of the little sections is to put in conclusion. You know, you love a conclusion to the paper, but to say at the end of your say, so in conclusion, the background shows that there's a problem here, it needs to be addressed, we're going to address it, and the research question is this. Because in conclusion, kind of, if you're listening to a public presentation, and somebody's droning on, like I am just now, and then they say, and in conclusion, everybody wakens up and says, thank God he's nearly finished, what's he actually been saying, you know? So it works with writing too. So. Tables and figures, again, there's nothing more bamboozling, nothing worse for a reviewer, certainly, and to lose their attention by having poor tables and figures. So just look at how others present them. I mean, there are good examples and bad examples, but copy that. Don't use raw statistical, like those of you who are doing quantitative research, using SAS, SPSS, and R, and things like that. Don't just churn out the outputs from these. They're absolutely hopeless. Nobody's interested in them. Far too much material. You have to represent them. And the number of people, especially my PhD students are not lazy. They're all very hard working. But they say, but SPSS allows you to make tables. I say, yeah, and they're crap as well. You know, so just they're awful. Just redraw them, okay? There's far too much info. Sorry for hard work there, but say. Okay, be parsimonious. Get as much information as possible across with as little writing and presentation as possible. Think out how you're going to make sure that as much information comes across and the table stands alone. So, also these days, it's also worth knowing that you can append material and put it online. I know that's a question. I'm making a statement. You can. You've got to ask yourself, actually, do I need this in the paper? Could I not just make it available if people want to see it? Knowing full well that very few will actually look at it, but if that's the case, then you don't need it in your paper. But you can certainly append raw data, syntax, and things like that. Don't put them in the paper. So that's hopeless, you see. That, you can't tell anything from that, can you? I mean, it's just awful, you know. You know, unless you've got one of these sort of photographic memories that can look at it. So don't present tables like that. Absolutely hopeless. I've just got no idea why they would. Okay, it's got all the information there, but, you know, if somebody really needs to be shocked for a table like that, I don't know exactly how you can present it better, but there must be a better way than that. That is the kind of thing I'm talking about, okay? And absolutely, it's got the question at the top, it's got favour, oppose, don't know, it's nothing to do with nursing necessarily, it's got the dates of when people answered it, shows the trend, it's got the demographics underneath, everything you need to know. You don't need to know anything else about that study necessarily. You know exactly how people answered that question and what the demographics were and how it changed over the years just by looking at it. Brilliant. Okay? So that's a really good example of a good table. Not from my journal, as it happens. Now, moving off the grabbing the reader's attention a little bit, but I will come back to the reviewers in a bit. I think that part of the process is seeking criticism of your writing. So if you think you, I've been to a lecture by Roger Watson that was brilliant, of course, and I'm going to follow everything that he said. But still my paper got rejected, he must have been wrong. But one step that a lot of people miss out is they don't let somebody else read the paper. Now, if you're working in teams and with a supervisor, you probably will have a natural reader. But if you don't, I think you should find somebody, you know. So find a critical friend to look at your paper. It always helps. And it doesn't have to be an expert, it doesn't have to be somebody senior. It can be your partner, your wife, your husband. In my case, my children, my biggest critics, you know. I've got to read their essays for university, so you can read this. You know, I don't understand it. Well, that's a good point. If they don't understand it, what have I done? I haven't made it clear, you know. So find somebody who's going to read it and actually engage with it and actually make changes and show you what to do. So seek criticism of your... That's no good. Don't find the local departmental lunatic who always says everything is a lot wrong and shouts at you. We've all got colleagues like this. I had one in my last university, and nobody ever goes through with a paper, because it's all really rubbish, you know? It's no good, because what you've written isn't rubbish. Some of it's rubbish, and it could be made better, okay? That's always got to be the opinion. But you don't want big hugs either, you know? Some person who comes and takes what you've written and says, you know, that's brilliant, because it isn't brilliant, it could be changed, it could be made better. So don't go for these extremes. Find somebody who's been been there preferably, and will help you to get higher up. That's the best person, okay? And you know, these people, you know, these saintly people can be become a little bit overwhelmed with stuff to do, but the best people will do it quickly. You know, you don't want people to read every, you know, to spend hours over it. Just have a quick read of it, because that's all the editor's going to do. That's all the reviewers are going to do. If they don't get it in a quick read, it's finished. You know, get them to have a quick read, and you know, this needs to be shifted. Take those words out, and I'll give you an example of that later. You know, tighten up the arguments by saying this. The sort of general comments, like it's very weak, it's very disorganized, no use. It's weak because you haven't done this. It's disorganized because that's in the wrong place. That's the kind of stuff you want. And then you should be willing to do it for your colleagues as well. Don't become a selfish academic. So find a critical friend. What you're going to do, just in case you're not clear on the kind of person, is find the type of person who will tell a man, I've always got to check my zip at this moment, you'll see why, who will tell a man that his trouser zipper is open, okay? Now, if you're a man, and there's some men in the room, and your trouser zipper has been open all day, and you're walking along the street, and nobody tells you, and you go home, and your wife says, why, you know your trouser zipper's been open, why didn't somebody tell me? And that's exactly what you want with writing. Why didn't somebody tell me that there was something wrong here, okay? It's an analogy, isn't it? Okay. So, don't expect to write a paper and to send it to a journal. Write a paper, revise it yourself, give it to somebody else, they'll give you revisions to do, let it sit for a while, have another look at it, send it to the journal, it'll come back, if you're lucky, with more revisions to do. The best writers are not the greatest writers, as James Michener said, he was one of the world's greatest rewriters. All the best writers are, they rewrite and they work on their writing. So you're never going to get down to the stage where you can do this in an afternoon. None of us are at that stage. You will get to the stage where you can do it quicker, but you will never get to the stage where you can do it once off and send it off. It never works. So expect revisions. Now try to make your paper, again, this is back to a couple of final points before my voice runs out. International relevance is very important. Excuse me, just have a drink of vodka. international relevance is very important to keep people's attention, because this is a fact. We looked at the citations of papers in our journal, and it was one of my editors, I had never noticed this, and I tried to study it very closely, but one of my editors decided to pull the papers out in a slightly different way. They said to me, or said to the assembled mass of the management team, you realise that papers with countries in the titles are the lowest cited papers in the journal, and very often zero cited. Okay? So the worst thing you can do to your paper from the ultimate citation point of view, and from our point of view now, because we don't want to see this, because we want the papers to be cited, is to say, a study of cognitive behavioural therapy in post-myocardial patients in Finland. Don't say that. Just nobody's interested. It's a study of post-myocardial patients. That's it. Yeah, you've got to explain it's done in Finland, that's the setting. But for some reason, that in the title is a big put-off for people. It immediately puts people off reading it. And I have to say, any North Americans present, they're usually everywhere. Yes, it particularly puts off North Americans. And I mean, people in the USA in particular. You don't seem to be interested in what happens anywhere else in the world. So there you go. We can argue about that. Anyway. This is just an observation. I mean, so just a hint to try and keep the country out of the title. However, there's more to it than that. You've got to keep asking yourself, here in Finland, as much as I do in the UK, and as much as you do in America, States, okay? Yeah, sounds very general in North America. In the States, will somebody else, somewhere else in the world, have any interest in this paper? And because the answer you hope is yes, but how will you make it of less interest? You'll make it less interest by putting in expressions and terminology that they won't get. Now, for example, in the UK, we're very bad, and if you read papers in the Journal of Advanced Nursing, you may still see papers with this in it, but I try to eliminate it. People talk about NHS, trusts. Now, the NHS is the National Health Service, which is our health service in the UK. Trusts are these horrible big organisations that run the hospitals and the community care. No, it doesn't have any relevance anywhere else in the world. But if you mention an NHS trust is the organisational unit of the health service, people immediately get it. They understand it. Even in Scotland, we don't have trusts. We have health boards. So it's just an example. Australians talk about nurses, nurse unit managers. You know, I don't know if that's a manager or a nurse, but explain, it's the person who's got responsibility for a clinical area, that kind of thing. There's lots of other examples, so jargon and cliches, these sort of things, try to make them as international as possible. So refer the names and the background to the global relevance of the topic. Try and make it as big as possible. Try not to confine yourself to try not to make it look like a small local study. In fact, don't ever say that in your title, but we do get them in. A small local study of. No, it's a study of. The readers can judge whether it's small and local. Don't shoot yourself in the foot as soon as you walked in the saloon. So refer to the global relevance of the topic as much as you can. Include the names of countries in the abstract where the work was taken. That seems to be okay. You've got to. You can't hide it, okay? And emphasise the international relevance of the results in your conclusions. Now, by international relevance, I don't necessarily mean global health implications, although that's becoming much more important. What I mean is referring to the international literature, you know, putting it in the widest possible context. So if your study is just about a study in Kuopio that's only relevant to the local hospital, has no relevance elsewhere, I'm sorry, it will not fit this sort of scheme, but it might get published locally. But if you've done a bigger study, or you've done a big study in the hospital that you think might have relevance, and you can draw it out, do it by all means, but just think very carefully. Adhere to international guidelines very quickly. If it's a randomised controlled trial, use the CONSORT guidelines. I haven't got any time to go into this in detail. If it's a systematic review, use the PRISMA guidelines. In terms of authorship, we adhere kind of to the ICMJ, the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors guidelines, whereby if you've designed or analysed or written the paper and agreed to the contents, you can be an author. If you haven't designed, analysed or written it and you haven't agreed to the contents, you shouldn't be an author. Simple as that. We don't want to hear about squabbles and arguments about authorship, but it's very common. So there's clear guidance on the website about authorship. We also would like people to, if I came in today at 3 o'clock whenever we start and said, guys, have a look at the COPE website, that's all I'm going to do today, and went out again, and I've done my job. It's about ethics, publication ethics. Have a good look at this. I know it's a UK-based initiative, the Lancet and the BMJ, but there are translations into all sorts of languages of the guidelines. They're now international. There are ethical guidelines for authors, for editors, for reviewers, and for publishers, and there are also procedures which we have to follow if we suspect that somebody has committed a breach of ethical practice in publication. So I think you should really pay attention to some of that. It's got a web page. And we check every paper for similarity. I know it's called plagiarism detection or whatever, but we can't detect plagiarism. All we can do is detect similarity. We've then got to decide if it's plagiarised. So try not to lift other people's work or duplicate your own work. It's not as easy not duplicating, but just be very careful. We'll be on to you. Every single manuscript goes through. You will not escape if you've done anything too bad. Right, you will not grab anybody's attention if your writing is full of too many words. So try and get rid of the clutter, try and get rid of words. Now, I'm a native English speaker from Scotland. I know this is more difficult than another language to explain, but if you have any difficulties with English, then do get a native English speaker to read your papers and tell you how to shorten them and get rid of words. A Finnish person who's fluent in English will not do this. It's got to be a native English speaker to do this. Hand on heart, I've seen the results of local linguists, doing it. I'm in the English department. I know how to speak English, not like it ought to be written, So do see if you've got native English speakers around to do this kind of thing. I'm not criticising your writing's bad at all. Some non-English speaking people's writing is better than my academic colleagues back home. We suffer from the same problem. So use clear, simple writing. This here says, with what frequency has your child experienced a raised temperature within the last 30 days? Can easily be broken down to how many times has your child had a fever in the last month? That's the sort of thing that I'm trying to sort of examples I'm trying to give. Often the first word that you use is the right one. Don't struggle to try and find more clever terms, bigger words, or more expansive ways of describing things. just use the first word that comes to your mind. If you don't know a word, this is a hint about writing, if you don't know a word, if you know there's a technical term out there for something which should be the right one and you can't think of it, put a note to yourself and carry on writing. Don't say, that's it, I can't do any more. If you can't think of the word for elephant, put big animal, big ears and long nose and brackets and move on and then come back and then you'll remember what it's elephant, that's right. Okay? Don't seek to use polysyllabic words. Don't use jargon. I'm sure you've got Finnish jargon. You've got lots of English jargon. Don't use it, common words. Don't use cliches either. Now, if you want to find out about writing style, there's a book. This is Helen Sword, and the name of the book's completely escaped me, but I can find it later and tell Mary. It's about writing style, and it's an academic study of different styles of writing across nursing, medicine, engineering, humanities. It's a huge study, and she looks at the way people write. And she gives this example here, which I'm going to read out. Rarely is there an effective conceptual link between the current understanding of the centrality of text-to-knowledge production and student learning and the pragmatic problems of policy imperatives in the name of efficiency and capacity building. I mean, that's just nonsense. That's from a real academic paper. I mean, it's just that's the sort of thing, just garbage. But there are some nurses who like to think they ought to write like that. It's pretty meaningless stuff, you know. So if you've got, there's 88 words in one sentence. This is what you've got to do. That's how I write. I just spew it out like that. I don't think while I'm writing. I write. I don't edit while I'm writing. I write. Then what you're going to do, don't read that, but what you're going to do is just go through and do this kind of thing. Score stuff out. Join it together. You know, start the sentences again. Score more out. Join the sentences up. Break it down into more sentences. Get rid of stuff. And if you're lucky, you'll then get down to 52 words and 5 sentences without any loss of meaning, okay? Now, I'll give you that slide and you can go through that as an example. I've got lots of examples like that, but that's what you've got to do to get it down. Somebody will read that with interest. They won't read the other thing with interest. That might grab their attention, the other certainly won't. Dealing with reviewers' comments. Now, this is a crucial stage in the process, and you can blow it at this stage completely if you don't deal with things properly. Now, there's a very good paper which I can send to you. I'll send it to Mary. She can send out to you by Williams. It's from the American Journal of Dermatology, and he presents some golden rules for dealing with viewers' comments. And I just reproduce them here because I completely agree with them. First of all, answer completely. Now, answering completely is quite simple. It means answering everything that you're asked to do. So when you're given a review back on a paper, it may be done in a series of points, or it may be done as a block of text. However, you should pull out all the points you can and put them in to a table and answer them all. This doesn't mean to say that if you can't answer it or the reviewer's wrong, that you just ignore it. What you should do is careful how you point out to reviewers they're wrong, but you've got to address that point. You can't just ignore it. The worst thing that really gets up reviewers' backs, and I see it in the comments, and I know it as a reviewer, I know it as an editor, is when authors ignore what they've said. That's the worst possible thing. So answer completely, answer politely, okay? It never helps to be rude. We try to encourage our reviewers to be polite, and sometimes they're not so polite, but we drop them like the proverbial hot brick, that's an idiom, if they're not polite. We really see no need for people to be rude. We've all done it when we're a bit younger and a bit more arrogant, but as you get older you begin to learn that anybody can do that, it gets you nowhere. Don't be rude back, it doesn't help. Apart from anything else, the reviewers have spent some time reviewing your paper. Answer with evidence as well, don't just say I disagree, you know. So answering completely. Deal with every point, even if you don't agree with it. There are ways of doing it, of course, and that's where evidence comes in. Don't ignore the points. And I haven't got an example here, but a good thing is to produce a table, number all the points. So, number of points, page the original point was on, what the reviewer said, how you've addressed it, and the page on which you've addressed it, and do it in red if the journal allows you to do it in the journal, so it's easy to find, and then any other comments at the end of that. For example, if you couldn't answer it, couldn't address it, you can put a reference in there that they can check themselves. Make a list of points even if you're not presented with it. answer politely. Don't start with, you know, we completely disagree with the comments of the reviewer. So don't say, you know, who on earth are your reviewers? That kind of thing. Well, I get it. I get it at conferences. I get people coming up with, who are your reviewers? I say, but something rejected of you, how did I know? You know, it's, nobody ever complains of it being accepted. You know, nobody's ever come to me and said, you realise that paper was rubbish and you accepted it. They always say it was brilliant, but you rejected it. Funny human nature, isn't it? Yes. If you disagree with the reviewer, then provide the evidence, the facts, and the references. The other thing is that if, at the end of the process, you feel you've been unfairly dealt with, we do have appeals processes in journals. We're obliged to have them. COPE insists we have them, and that's a good thing too. Not many people go down the appeals road, and I would appeal to you, as an editor-in-chief, not to go down it yourselves unless you really feel you've got a strong case. Most of them we don't uphold. Most of them are differences in opinions, and that doesn't count. Somebody thinks it's good, somebody thinks it's bad. Somebody thinks it's good because of this, somebody... We'd be here forever. Grow up, send your paper somewhere else. You know, don't get involved in these things. However, if there's a clear error can be addressed, and you can address it, we will occasionally say, okay. But the paper will always be reviewed again independently, you know, so you may end up in that process again. So I shouldn't try and put you off the appeals process, but it gives me a lot of work to do. But it's always a bit of a heart sink moment when you see an appeal coming in. But I'm just saying that really, for your own sake, you're slowing the process down. And I know that in Scandinavia here, you have to get papers out to get your PhDs and things like that. But we're reasonable chaps, you know, we're reasonable people. But as I say, try not to, don't appeal every time your paper gets rejected. It's a waste of time, and you will get a reputation for it. Okay, so nearly there. There's a fantastic book written, there you go. I didn't know the slide was there, honestly. No, okay, there's a book published, it's edited by Karen Holland from Elsevier and myself and Wiley, so it's two publishing houses. It's published by Wiley and it's multi-authored, and that's available for you to buy. I've got 6 grandchildren and they will get Christmas presents if you... It's also available digitally if you like. I don't know how much that costs. I also, as I said, edit Nursing Open. I don't have time to talk, unless you want me to, about open access publishing, but I would say one thing. Be very, very careful, okay? The academics amongst us here will know what I'm talking about. We get inundated every day with requests to sit on the board, edit, submit papers to, review for open access journals, and 99% of them are just criminals, basically, trying to get your money from you, trying to get your money from you and us to work for them for nothing. As you progress through your academic and clinical careers and get a reputation for publishing, these sharks are out there looking, and they'll write to you and try to get you, and people fall for it. We're very big in social media, and I'm very happy as well for people to email me if you've got any questions. I never get inundated, so don't worry. Don't think, well, I'm not emailing, must be getting hundreds of questions. I get hundreds of stupid questions from other people, but as a result of meeting people and talking to them, I'm always glad. If you say, I like your presentation, I'd like to clarify, or you want to know anything, don't hesitate. Follow me on Twitter, I'm very interesting. And the Journal of Advanced Nursing has now got 11,500 followers. We're soon going to have a Facebook page, and we've also got... It's called JAN Interactive. If you Google JAN Interactive, it'll take you. That's the URL. We've got a blog where you're welcome to interact and make comments on papers. You can send us contributions for the blog about almost anything that you think is relevant. I mean, it's got to be relevant. We'll probably put it up there. You can blog about papers you've published if you want. We also encourage people to make YouTube presentations when they've published. So we like to see your face, and some people... brilliant at doing this. Writing, getting a paper published, getting it in a journal, it's not the end. You know, then you've got to work at promoting it. And these days you've got to work hard to promote it. So not the end of the process, it's actually the start. We also have a podcasting facility. Again, very few people use this. Most of the JAN podcasts are me saying things, but we've got lots of podcasts up there. You can find them on the blog, you can find them on the Twitter feed. But we also invite people to do podcasts of the paper, just a summary of the paper, why did you do it. So there's all sorts of ways you can promote your paper once you've got it published, if you get it published. Thank you very much.
So much for this very stimulating and interesting presentation. And now we have time to share questions, comments, so please. Yes, please.
I'll stand over here for a question. Just for a change. Oh, yes, look, there's all these people in the room.
Yes.
Hi.
Please.
Yeah, just shout out.
Oh, no, I can stand.
Okay.
Yes.
80.5 papers rejected.
Yeah.
80.5% papers rejected in 2014 alone.
Yeah.
And only 19.5 accepted.
Yeah.
The house is jam packed, full of students and staffs, I believe, because we want to hear from you a reason why it is that number,
yeah,
and what we can do.
Okay.
I would like to know, but that's not the first thing I want, is why.
This podcast was produced in association with youthpublications limited.com.